Welcome to Cut and Thrust, your podcast for the bloody and sometimes bizarre journey through the Middle Ages. Whether it's dark battles, questionable hygiene, or hair-raising rulers, here you'll get history as it really was, raw and unfiltered. So grab your sword, put on your helmet, and let's dive into the wild world of the past.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Battle Merchant Podcast. I'm Hendrik.
And I'm Carmen. And today we're tackling a topic that really gets under your skin, quite literally.
The Black Death, the plague in the Middle Ages, one of the greatest catastrophes humanity has ever experienced.
And that's not an exaggeration. When we talk about pandemics today, we have certain ideas in mind. But what happened in Europe between 1347 and 1351 is really beyond comprehension.
True. So, what exactly are we talking about? The plague was caused by a bacterium called Yersinia pestis. People at the time knew nothing about this, of course. Bacteria were completely unknown. But this tiny thing depopulated entire regions.
What's always interested me, where does the name Black Death actually come from? It sounds very dramatic.
That's actually fascinating. Many people think it comes from the skin discoloration in the sick, from the dark spots. But it's not that simple. The term wasn't actually used in the Middle Ages itself.
Right. Back then they called it pestis or mortalitas, the great mortality. The expression Black Death actually comes from a much older literary tradition, atra mors, the ominous deadly death.
And the term only became popular in the 19th century. There was a German physician, Justus Hecker, who wrote a book in 1832, The Black Death in the 14th Century.
And that was during the cholera epidemics. That's why the book made such an impact.
Exactly. And from there, the name caught on. So it's a later designation, not a medieval one.
But back to the scale of the catastrophe. When we talk about numbers, we need to be careful. The sources from that time obviously aren't as precise as modern statistics.
Absolutely. The blog post mentions about a third of the European population. Modern historians estimate the figures were somewhere between 30 and 60%, depending on the region. That's an enormous range.
And even if we calculate conservatively, how do you explain that? Imagine every third person you know.
Just gone. Within a few years. When I try to translate that into modern terms, COVID was devastating, no question. But the plague wiped out entire villages. Completely.
And that, of course, had effects on everything. Agriculture suffered massive regional collapses due to the labor shortage. Not completely collapsed everywhere, but severe upheavals. The economy was completely transformed.
The social structures too. The feudal system began to falter in many places because suddenly labor was in short supply. The survivors could often demand higher wages, though this varied by region and sometimes there was resistance. That was unthinkable before.
And from a religious perspective, it was of course traumatic. Many saw the plague as God's punishment. There were flagellants, processions, Jewish pogroms. People were desperately searching for explanations.
Medieval medicine was completely helpless against it. They didn't even know what made people sick. Bad air, unfavorable planetary alignments, divine wrath. Those were the theories.
And yet people tried to protect themselves. Quarantine measures, for example, were developed during that time. The word itself comes from that era. 40 giorni, 40 days of isolation.
Right. It was first introduced in Ragusa, today's Dubrovnik, in 1377 for arriving ships. Venice then adopted and standardized it. That was one of the few approaches that actually helped. Without knowing why, of course.
The plague fundamentally changed the medieval world. But before we get to the consequences, let's first look at where it all actually came from. But where did the plague actually come from, geographically speaking? The bacterium didn't just appear in Europe out of nowhere.
The origin lies in Central Asia. Modern genetic analysis have been able to pinpoint it quite precisely, somewhere in the region of present-day Kyrgyzstan. And from there, the disease spread along the trade routes.
The Silk Road. That was the trade network of the world at that time. This connection between Asia and Europe. Caravans, merchants, goods of all kinds. And also unwanted passengers.
The rats. And the fleas on the rats. That's an important factor. With pneumonic plague, it was then droplet infection.
And then there's this story from Kaffa, which is on the Crimean Peninsula. In 1346, the city was besieged by the Mongols, by the Golden Horde under Khan Janibek. And it's said the Mongols catapulted plague corpses over the walls.
The famous story of the first biological warfare.
Yes, but historically that's highly disputed. The only source for it is an Italian notary, Gabriele de Mussi, and he wasn't even there himself. It's hearsay that he wrote down.
It's more likely that the plague came to Kaffa through ordinary trade. When the siege was lifted and the grain trade resumed, with the rats and fleas in the cargo.
From Kaffa, Genoese merchant ships then set sail. And they carried the disease directly to the major Mediterranean ports. Messina, Genoa, Venice.
Marseille.
Marseille, right. That was 1347. And from these port cities, it then spread rapidly into the hinterland.
The speed is really remarkable when you consider how slow everything was back then. No cars, no trains, everything on foot or by horses and ships. And yet, the plague reached almost all of Europe within just about 3 or 4 years.
That was due to the infrastructure. The trade routes were like a network spanning all of Europe. And people were constantly moving along these routes. Merchants, soldiers, pilgrims. Anyone could carry the disease without knowing it.
And the cities were ideal breeding grounds. Densely built, many people in a small space. No sewage system as we know it. The rats felt right at home.
The major trading centers were hit first. Florence, Paris, London.
Cologne, Hamburg, Lübeck. The Hanseatic cities.
Exactly. The Hanseatic League. The trade networks that had actually brought prosperity became their downfall. The better connected a city was, the earlier and harder it was hit.
That's almost, how do you say it, a bitter irony. The trade that had made medieval Europe so prosperous became the vehicle for its greatest enemy.
And there was no way to stop it. People didn't know what was causing the disease. They only saw that ships arrived, and shortly afterward, people died. Some cities tried to close their ports, but usually it was already too late.
The disease was faster than any news. By the time a city learned that the plague had broken out in a neighboring region, merchants had often already brought it in.
A perfect storm, really. The trade networks, the dense population in cities, the lack of hygiene, the absence of medical knowledge. All of that together made the plague so deadly.
But the actual culprit, this bacterium Yersinia pestis that we mentioned at the very beginning, wasn't identified until much later, in 1894, by Alexandre Yersin, a Swiss physician doing research in Hong Kong.
So over 500 years after the great outbreak, people in the 14th century had no idea what they were dealing with. They only saw the symptoms.
And those varied depending on the form of plague. There are actually three main forms. The best known is bubonic plague, the one with the swollen lymph nodes, the so-called buboes. They can grow as large as chicken eggs and appear mainly in the groin, under the armpits and on the neck.
Then there's septicemic plague, where the bacterium enters the bloodstream directly. It often progressed so quickly that people died before buboes could even develop.
And the third form, that one is particularly...
Pneumonic plague.
Pneumonic plague. That was by far the most dangerous. Because it wasn't transmitted through fleas, but through droplet infection. Coughing, sneezing, speaking, that was enough.
That also explains why the mortality rate for pneumonic plague was so much higher. With bubonic plague, some people actually survived, perhaps 20 to 40%. With pneumonic plague, practically no one. Without treatment, it was almost always fatal, within 2 to 3 days.
But back to transmission for the most common form, bubonic plague. The chain is actually simple. Rat carries flea, flea carries bacterium, rat dies, flea seeks new host, finds human, bites, infection.
And that was precisely the problem. Rats were everywhere. In the houses, in the storerooms, on the ships. People lived with them without knowing what danger they posed.
When an infected rat dies, the fleas leave the cooling body and search for a new, warm host. And the next warm body nearby was often a human. The flea bites, and in doing so, the bacteria enter the bloodstream.
What always amazes me, the plague still exists today. It's not purely a historical phenomenon.
Right. The WHO reports several hundred to over 2,000 cases worldwide each year, depending on the year. Mainly in Madagascar, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, in Peru, but also in the USA, in the western states like...
New Mexico, Arizona, California.
There are natural reservoirs in rodent populations there. About 7 to 20 cases per year in the USA.
The crucial difference from back then, today we have antibiotics. If the plague is detected early, ideally within 24 hours, it's highly treatable. Mortality drops to about 8 to 10%. Without treatment, it would still be as deadly as in the Middle Ages, with pneumonic plague nearly 100%.
That also puts the question of why the plague was so devastating into perspective. It wasn't just about the bacterium itself, but about the fact that there was no effective treatment whatsoever. People were completely at its mercy.
And they didn't understand how transmission worked. They tried everything possible, but most of it didn't help, or even made things worse. What did people in the Middle Ages actually try to do to fight the plague? They didn't know a bacterium was the cause.
And now, a quick word from our sponsor. Feeling curious? Then head over to battlemerchant.com. They've got all sorts of medieval stuff, from costumes to armor and loads more. Totally worth a look.
Medicine at the time was based on a completely different worldview. The foundation was the so-called humoral pathology, the theory of the four bodily humors. It goes back to Hippocrates and Galen from antiquity.
Blood, phlegm, yellow bile, black bile. The idea was that diseases arise from an imbalance of these humors. So physicians try to restore this balance.
And that primarily meant bloodletting. They would open a vein and let blood flow out. Or cupping. Glass vessels were placed on the skin, which drew blood to the surface through negative pressure.
Then there was the miasma theory. It stated that diseases were transmitted through, how should I put it, through corrupted air, bad emanations, putrid smells.
That's why people used perfumes, carried herbal bouquets, burned incense. They thought if they purified the air, they would protect themselves from infection.
Which, of course, didn't work from today's perspective. But it explains many of the measures taken at the time. The treatment methods were often drastic. Herbal poultices on the buboes, special healing potions, amulets.
And some doctors lanced the buboes to drain the pus.
That was extremely painful and, of course, didn't help. On the contrary, it probably increased the risk of infection.
And then there's that iconic image of the plague doctor with the beaked mask. Everyone knows it.
Yes, and that's exactly where we need to be careful. These beaked masks, they're not from the time of the Black Death. They date from the 17th century, about 300 years later.
Absolutely. That's one of the most persistent myths. You see it at every medieval market, but historically it doesn't belong there at all.
The first verified evidence comes from Rome, 1656, during a later plague outbreak, documented by Thomas Bartholin in 1661. The idea of a nose piece with aromatic substances is attributed to Charles Delorme, a French court physician. From that, the beak developed, filled with herbs. The miasma theory again.
So the mask was based on the same false assumption, but it still becomes a symbol of the plague, even though it didn't exist at the time of the Black Death.
Physicians in the 14th century wore concealing garments, perhaps cloths soaked in vinegar over their noses. There was no standardized protective clothing yet, and no beaked masks. That's a modern misconception that arose from images and films.
Alongside these medical attempts, there was of course also the religious dimension that we briefly touched on. The interpretation as God's punishment was very strong.
This led to penitential rituals, processions, and there were the flagellants, people who publicly
flogged themselves. They marched through the cities and whipped themselves to appease God's wrath.
A desperate reaction. And sadly, the search for scapegoats also led to Jewish pogroms. People were looking for explanations, and some resorted to terrible measures.
But let's remember the quarantine that we already discussed. That was one of the measures that actually helped, without people understanding the exact reason.
This pragmatic approach, the isolation of ships and travellers as first practiced in Ragusa, was a crucial step based on pure observation.
Interesting that the simplest measure, keeping distance, isolating, was the most effective, entirely without medical knowledge about the pathogen.
Cities also quarantined the infected and their families, sealed off entire houses. Travellers were checked at city borders. These were the beginnings of what we know today as epidemic control. So what remains after the Black Death? When a third of the population dies, it fundamentally changes a society.
We hinted at it earlier. The most immediate consequence was the massive labour shortage. Suddenly, there were far fewer people to work the fields, work in the workshops, transport goods. And that fundamentally changed the power dynamics.
The survivors could demand higher wages. For the first time, peasants and common workers had real bargaining power against the landowners. That was unthinkable before.
And that had long-term consequences for the entire
feudal system.
The feudal system, exactly. That rigid order, where everyone had their fixed place, began to crumble. Not immediately, but the plague, at least in Western Europe, accelerated existing changes. Elsewhere, it was sometimes different.
In England, there was the Great Peasants' Revolt in 1381. Thousands marched on London. The new self-confidence of the working population manifested itself very concretely.
And then the cultural processing. People had to cope with this trauma somehow. Mass graves everywhere, entire families wiped out. That leaves its mark.
Memento mori. Remember that you will die. This motif became ubiquitous in art. And the dance of death depictions, where skeletons dance with people of all classes, from king to beggar, death makes everyone equal.
A dark art, but also an honest one. People confronted their mortality in a way that we hardly know anymore today.
Religiously, the upheaval was enormous. If the plague really was God's punishment, why did priests and monks die too? Why did no prayer help? Some lost their faith, others became even more devout.
But there were also positive developments. From this catastrophe emerged the first systematic approaches to epidemic control. Quarantine was further developed and refined.
Cities learned that isolation worked, even though they didn't understand why. That was the foundation for the modern concept of public health.
And medical thinking began to change. Slowly over centuries, but the plague had shown that the old theories weren't sufficient. That created space for new ideas.
What can we learn from this? The plague shows how vulnerable societies are to epidemics, but also how resilient people can be, how they adapt, create new structures.
And that measures like quarantine and hygiene aren't modern inventions. The basic principles were developed over 600 years ago, out of bitter necessity.
The history of the plague is dark, no question. But it's also a story of survival and transformation. Europe recovered and was a different continent afterward.
And with that, we've reached the end of our episode on the Black Death. A heavy topic, but one that shows how much history still influences our lives today.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to learn more about the Middle Ages, check out battlemerchant.com. On the blog, you'll find many more fascinating historical topics.
Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.
Bye.
And so we ride towards the end of this episode. Keep your sword sharp and your mugs full. We'll catch you in the next one.